KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If you go to a supermarket and buy 5 pounds of sugar, this is not going to break your food budget. But if you're producing candy, this is a big deal.
Another big round of tariffs is coming tomorrow. What impact will they have on products made in America?
Today is Tuesday, April 1st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, who loses when the federal government holds back money from universities?
Also, it's not a filibuster, but it looks like one.
Democratic Senator Cory Booker speaks for hours against the Trump agenda.
I am not going to stop speaking. I am going to not stop standing. I'm going to go for as long as I'm physically able to go.
Also, if you feel like a springtime escape to Paris, the new book Adventures in the Louvre takes you there, crowds and all.
It's kind of like a disappointing lover for the first time. You know, you sort of think, oh God, okay, is this what it's going to be like?
First the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Layoffs at the Department of Health and Human Services are now underway. The Trump administration says the layoffs of about 10,000 workers will save about $1.8 billion annually. That is still just a fraction of the agency's $1.7 trillion budget. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin says notices to employees began going out early this morning.
Some people woke up to the news in their inboxes. Some didn't, so they headed into work, and at several buildings there were lines of workers snaking around the block. Many found out they had been fired when they tried to badge into the building, and their badge didn't work. Jennifer Hainig's whole team was cut. She's a statistician who oversees a national survey on drug use and health. She saw the email early this morning before going to work in Rockville, Maryland, but she says not everyone did.
The dismissals included researchers, scientists, doctors, support staff, and senior leaders. HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced plans to remake the department last week. Wisconsin's state Supreme Court race is happening today. Out-of-state fundraising, including by George Soros and Elon Musk, helped to make it the most expensive judicial race in U.S. history. Wisconsin Public Radio's Nick Rommel reports the national attention did not go unnoticed by local voters.
A senior center in Germantown, a Milwaukee suburb, was bustling on Election Day. Voters were casting ballots in the race between liberal Susan Crawford and conservative Brad Schimmel. One was Jessica Coons. She said constant election ads didn't affect her Crawford vote, but knowing who was paying for the ads did.
Those don't really affect me as much as knowing what's all being put into it.
Steve Tuchik said he was surprised the race got so much national attention.
I was surprised by it. I really was. But I believe our nation's headed in the right direction now.
He said he would have voted for Schimmel whether or not Musk had supported him. For NPR News, I'm Nick Rommel in Germantown, Wisconsin.
Russia says it cannot accept White House proposals to end the war in Ukraine as currently presented. The Russian comments coming in response to President Trump's growing frustration over the Kremlin's unwillingness to accept a wider ceasefire. From Moscow, NPR's Charles Maines reports.
Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov told a Russian policy journal Moscow took the U.S. peace proposals seriously, but argued they'd done little so far to address the root causes of the conflict. Doing so, said Rybkov, would require a formal end to Ukraine's bid to join the NATO alliance and Kyiv's acceptance of Russian control over 5 Ukrainian regions Moscow claims to have annexed. President Trump returned to office promising to negotiate a quick peace, only to find Russian demands have stymied even limited ceasefire deals. In turn, Trump has warned he may slap new tariffs and sanctions on Russian energy if he feels the Kremlin is dragging its feet on negotiations. Charles Maines, NPR News. Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 11 points. This is NPR. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi is directing federal prosecutors to seek the death penalty against 26-year-old Luigi Mangione, the man who's accused of gunning down UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson outside a Manhattan hotel last December. Bondi made the announcement today. Mangione faces separate federal and state charges in the case, including murder through use of a firearm. Mangione is currently being held in a New York jail and is awaiting trial. He has pleaded not guilty to some state charges. The pair of celebrity bald eagles in the mountains east of Los Angeles will soon have names. Students from three elementary schools in the area got the honor of choosing what the baby birds will be called and cast ballots today. KVCR's Madison Ahmed has more.
The third through fifth graders at Baldwin Lane Elementary in Big Bear have been watching the eaglet's parents since kindergarten.
Who knows the name of the eagles?
Jackie and Shadow.
Yeah, Jackie and Shadow. You've all grown up with Jackie and Shadow.
Tens of thousands of viewers from around the world have also been watching Jackie and Shadow, who have their own 24/7 live stream. Their two chicks hatched about a month ago and are now about 10 inches tall.
You're going to pick your two favorites.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sandy Steers, who runs the live stream, passed out ballots to students with 30 names for the chicks.
Sky, Crackle, Griffin.
Steers plans to announce the winners on Wednesday. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ahmet in Big Bear.
Crude oil futures prices edged lower today as traders brace for the possible effects of Trump administration tariffs tomorrow. Oil down 28 cents a barrel to settle at $71.20 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, also in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles. 8.7 billion, 400 million, 175 million. These are just some examples of the money that the federal government has withheld or is threatening to withhold from various colleges and universities, including the University of Pennsylvania, Columbia University, and Harvard University. That $8.7 billion figure was announced yesterday by the Trump administration, which said that it's reviewing federal grants and contracts awarded to Harvard because Harvard has not done enough to curb anti-Semitism. The figures are staggering, and this money helps fund a wide variety of work. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, the Vice Provost for Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, says the administration's move to cut funding amounts to a war on higher education. Dr. Emanuel also served under the Obama administration, and we should note he also is the father of Gabriella Emanuel, who's with NPR's Science Desk. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with some specific areas of work that these funding cuts could affect. Last night, in an email, Harvard's president, Alan Garber, said that the cuts would, quote, halt life-saving research and imperil important scientific research and innovation. I realize that you are not at Harvard, but I imagine you can explain what Garber means. What types of things does this funding support?
Well, I can tell you the kinds of things that we've done at Penn. Mm-hmm. We're looking at vaccines to prevent cancers. Let me put it in this context for you, Elsa. Since 2000, which was the end of the Human Genome Project, there have been five major advances in biology, sort of platform advances. There's been CRISPR technology to change genes. There's been CAR T therapy for cancers. There's been gene therapy. There's mRNA vaccines. And now there's these GLP-1 anti-obesity, anti-diabetes drugs. All of them, all five of them, were really born in labs in universities and medical schools, one in part with Denmark, American universities, all of that kind of novel breakthroughs that really help people.
Right. This money, it's not just for research. It's also for grants and loans to students. It also supports local economies, the community that lives around these universities. But let me ask you this, if I may push back a little. Harvard has the largest academic endowment in the world. Like in 2024, it was valued at more than $53 billion. I imagine there are a lot of people out there who might be wondering, why do schools like that need so much money from the federal government to begin with?
So look, we have an endowment, and first of all, it's not an endowment, it's multiple little endowments, an endowment for this professorship or that research. Most of that money is focused on very specific areas that the donor wanted. That's the first thing. The second thing is a large part of those endowments are used to support students whose families cannot afford to go to the university and are given full scholarships or partial scholarships. For example, every student at Penn whose family doesn't make $75,000 or more, right, is given a full scholarship that's worth $92,000. And that part of the endowment goes to support that. Part of the endowment goes to support other research initiatives, whether we're looking at new historical research, new scientific research, new research in economics. That's a large part of what the endowments do. And we can only use about 3-4% of the value that's accrued every year. So you might say, oh, it's $50 billion. But 3% of $50 billion is only $1.5 billion. And that's to support a very, very large organization at Harvard.
Yeah. Well, the Trump administration says that it is yanking money from many of these universities, though not from all of them, because of what it sees as a failure to combat anti-Semitism on campuses. Why can't the federal government use funding as leverage to address anti-Semitism?
First of all, you're taking funding from cancer research because you claim that they're not combating anti-Semitism enough. That's not, if you're Jewish, that's not going to be a good look, and that's not going to be something that is going to be favorable. The second thing I would say is they're not related, and they're not. You're putting pressure on the university doesn't mean that they're not addressing anti-Semitism. The important thing is to hold them accountable for anti-Semitism by holding them accountable for anti-Semitism, what they're doing to combat that on campus. I agree. Not all of our universities did a great job on anti-Semitism. I think that's a fig leaf for what they're really trying to do, which is bring down universities.
That is Dr. Zeke Emanuel of the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Elsa.
President Trump is preparing to announce another big round of tariffs tomorrow. He argues that import taxes help protect U.S. producers from foreign competition. Some domestic industries already enjoy special protection thanks to tariffs and other trade barriers. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on how those protections affect the rest of us.
The homegrown American product that's most sheltered from foreign competition today is sugar. Economist Wes Peterson says that's largely thanks to the Cuban Revolution.
Back in the 50s, we were getting all of our sugar from the Caribbean, mostly from Cuba. And then Fidel Castro came in and took over, and so we cut all of our relations with Cuba, and suddenly we weren't getting our sugar from the Caribbean anymore.
To encourage domestic sugar production, the U.S. government imposed strict limits on sugar imports. As a result, Americans now pay almost twice as much for sugar as people elsewhere around the world. The absolute cost is still fairly low, about 38 cents a pound last year. So Peterson, who's at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, says for most people, this trade barrier is easily overlooked.
If you go to a supermarket and buy 5 pounds of sugar, this is not going to break your food budget. But if you're producing candy and your main ingredient is sugar, this is a big deal.
Just ask Kirk Vashaw, a fourth-generation candy maker in Bryan, Ohio.
Dum Dums is our flagship brand. We're the only candy cane manufacturer in the United States.
Sugar is the main ingredient in those sweets, accounting for more than half the cost. So most of Vashaw's competitors have left the U.S. in search of cheaper sugar elsewhere. He understands that pressure.
If we were a public company, we would get closed down tomorrow and moved. But, you know, we're just doing our best to maintain our family business here in Bryan and support the community.
Vashaw's company, Spangler Candy, supports more than 500 employees in Ohio, not to mention businesses that supply machinery, packaging, and lollipop sticks, all of whose livelihoods are threatened by policies that keep the price of sugar in the U.S. artificially high. Customers who use sugar, which is most of us, far outnumber domestic sugar producers. But Peterson says those sugar producers still have a lot of political clout.
It's a lot easier to organize, to lobby the government if you're a fairly small, concentrated industry than if you're a large, diverse group of people like consumers. Consumers always have a hard time getting organized, whereas the producers are often very, very effective.
Policies that protect the domestic sugar industry have even outlasted Fidel Castro. Tariffs and other trade barriers often outlive their original purpose. Back in the 1960s, for example, the U.S. was unhappy with a German tax on imported chicken. So in retaliation, policymakers imposed a 25% tax on imported pickup trucks. That pickup truck tariff is still in place more than 50 years later, and it's reshaped the domestic auto industry. Chief economist Eugenio Alamon of Raymond James says U.S. carmakers have focused on building big pickup trucks that don't face foreign competition, while largely ignoring the market for smaller, cheaper cars.
This is one of the things that ties do. I mean, they distort markets.
Businesses that benefit from protectionist policies often have less incentive to invest, invent, and compete on the world stage. While building big pickup trucks has been very profitable for U.S. automakers here at home, Alamon says there's not much market for those vehicles elsewhere around the world.
Have you seen the roads in Europe? These are very old cities where American cars cannot turn the corner because they are so big that it's impossible.
Trade barriers can also be a disadvantage when domestic supplies run short. A few years ago, when one of a handful of baby formula factories in the U.S. was shut down due to contamination, nervous parents around the country were suddenly faced with empty store shelves. Eventually, the shortage was relieved with the help of imported baby formula, but only after government restrictions were relaxed. It's a reminder that sometimes the most reliable supply chain is not necessarily homegrown. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
When writing a speech for an event, conventional wisdom might suggest keep it to 5 minutes or so you don't lose people's attention.
Well, here in Washington, D.C., New Jersey Senator Cory Booker overshot that by a bit. He started speaking on the Senate floor at 7 p.m. last night and went for more than 24 hours.
Tonight, I rise with the intention of getting in some good trouble.
As he invoked the late civil rights leader, Representative John Lewis, Booker said he has heard the call from Democratic voters to do more. So that's what he says he's doing, protesting the Trump administration's actions and agenda.
But don't call his speech a filibuster. Those are meant to stall or block specific legislation. His aims are much broader.
In just 71 days, the president of the United States has inflicted so much harm on Americans' safety, financial stability.
Senator Booker's covered a wide range of topics: immigration, education, Social Security, health care. He has read letters from citizens, many of whom benefit from programs where funding is being threatened.
It's now the longest speech ever given on the Senate floor. At 20 hours in, around 3 p.m. Eastern time today, he still had a remarkable amount of energy to plead his case.
Well, I want to stand more, and I will, but I'm begging people, don't let this be another normal day in America. Please, God, don't let them take Medicaid away.
Tens of thousands of people have joined live streams of the speech.
And as of the time of this broadcast, Senator Booker is still speaking on the Senate floor. President Trump and Elon Musk have not commented publicly on the speech.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Two moms brought the business of the House of Representatives to a grinding halt today. It happened after House Speaker Mike Johnson and GOP leaders tried to derail their bill, a bill to allow remote voting for new parents. One of those moms was Florida Republican Anna Paulina Luna, who worked against her own leaders and prevailed.
Never bet against the Luna.
NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us from Capitol Hill. I would never bet against you either, Deirdre. Welcome.
Hi, Mary Louise.
What is in this bill and why were House Republican leaders so against it?
So this was a bill that these two moms teamed up to allow proxy voting for up to 12 weeks for parents around the birth of their child. I talked to House Speaker Mike Johnson hours before this vote, and he argued that remote voting was just unconstitutional.
So if you allow it for some situations, you're ultimately going to have to allow it for all. And I think that destroys the deliberative nature of the body.
The speaker said then he thought they had the votes to block this bill, but they did not. A total of 9 House Republicans voted with all Democrats to defeat a measure the speaker and his leadership team designed to try to kill the bill. It was a pretty stunning event on the House floor.
Yeah. And how did they do it? How did these two female lawmakers outmaneuver the speaker?
I mean, working together. After the vote, they were standing on the steps of the Capitol. It was Colorado Democratic Congresswoman Brittany Patterson. She had her 9-week-old baby, Sam, with her. She stood with Congresswoman Anna Paulina Luna, talked about how they coordinated to keep their coalition together. They were asked what their message to the speaker was, and I would say Patterson was very direct, so we made this a little family-friendly.
We said don't with moms.
I think he understands the historical significance of this.
Okay, so after we've heard that family-friendly comment, my next question is, what does the House do now?
I mean, the speaker actually canceled votes for the rest of the week. By defeating this measure today, they blocked Republican leaders from bringing up other House business for the rest of the week. There were Republican bills that were expected to pass along party lines. One focused on reining in judges who issue injunctions, another adding requirements to show proof of citizenship when voting. Once the speaker couldn't bring them up, he sent members home until next week, even though they have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. There were hurdles that these two lawmakers had to overcome to get to this vote today. What were they?
A lot of political hurdles and behind-the-scenes sort of hardball tactics. Luna told reporters last week leaders were making threats against Republican lawmakers who supported her bill. I could see during the vote inside the chamber, the speaker was talking to Republicans who had signed on to this proxy voting bill. Lawmakers of both sides of the aisle said, you know, it's 2025. It's time for Congress to catch up with the technology. A lot of other workplaces have adjusted for remote work. There are a lot of younger members here trying to grow their families. Luna afterward talked about this vote, demonstrating that a majority of the House is now on record.
We worked as a team, and I think that today is a pretty historical day for the entire conference, showing that the body has decided that parents deserve a voice in Washington, and also to the importance of female members having a vote in Washington, D.C.
And will these women get a vote on their bill?
I mean, if the House had stayed in session this week, it would have likely happened at the end of the week. But we'll have to see when they get back next week. Republican leaders are very opposed to this and tried to derail it. They could try again. But now we know there's a majority of members who want to change the rules of the House for new parents.
And NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Thank you, Deirdre.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
Nearly 30 years ago, the world was introduced to a group of artists from the golden age of Cuban music.
Dos gardenias para ti, con ella quiero decir.
The Buena Vista Social Club were musicians in their 70s and 80s who'd been all but lost to the public after the Cuban Revolution. They were reunited for a 1997 album which sold millions of copies around the globe. Now, their unlikely story takes a new stage on Broadway. NPR's Isabel Gomez-Sarmiento reports.
There is a music studio in Old Havana. Right now, you and I are 1,000 miles away. But a sound like this, it tends to travel.
The musical Buena Vista Social Club is a story about second chances. The characters are named after the real musicians who made the famous album, but these are not their stories. In real life, in the 1950s, the musicians who later became the Buena Vista Social Club were performers on the island. Pianist Ruben Gonzalez played with big bands at the Tropicana. The other artists played in clubs around Havana, until those were shut down during the revolution. Many of them took other jobs to make a living. The Cuba they were living in, it wasn't the Cuba they once knew. You can hear the longing in the original album, in this song, 20 años, 20 years.
They kind of take on this other level of meaning, so they're not just necessarily about an old lover, but it's about the island itself. And it's about home, and these songs that feel like they're about missing somebody also start to feel like they're about missing a place.
That's Marco Ramirez. He developed the musical and wrote the script.
When I first started out, so many people who didn't speak any Spanish would tell me, oh my God, this is like my go-to wine and cheese record.
Ramirez says it was a sweet sentiment, but...
Part of my goal became like, okay, I want you to hear this music in 3D next time. I want you to kind of understand some of the depth of the musicality, but also kind of lyrically and emotionally what's under here.
Like in real life, in the musical, a character named Juan de Marcos is trying to bring a group of older musicians together for an album. After that, the stories really diverge. But the important thing is that every character's story is about making things right. This really resonated with choreographer Patricia Delgado. Her parents left Cuba as children and never returned. So for her, Buena Vista Social Club is about healing some of those wounds.
People had to make choices to like uproot their life and build a new life for themselves and just try not to look back. I want to look back. This music helps me look back.
That's standout number Chan Chan. Like many of the songs in the musical and on the album, it was written by one of the company members years before. The rest are folk songs and other standards. There are about a dozen musicians on stage. They play trumpets, the Cuban bata drums, and even the tres, which is kind of like a folk guitar.
A lot of musicals are kind of built so that the songs can push the story forward. And what I really wanted to do here was make sure that the story pushed the songs forward.
Because it's the songs that carry the emotional truth of the story.
They're not easy emotions to navigate, and yet once you do navigate them and once you allow them to like wash over you, they can free you.
Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
In a new movie, Paul Rudd and Jenna Ortega play a father and daughter. They drive deep into the wilderness and hit a unicorn with their car.
I wasn't sure if it was totally dead, and then I bludgeoned it with a tire iron just to put it out of its misery.
The movie is called Death of a Unicorn. Our conversation with Rudd and director Alex Sharfman on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration acknowledges that it mistakenly deported a Maryland man to a mega prison in El Salvador.
If they are allowed to deport people whom the law prohibits them from deporting, then those laws are meaningless.
This amid growing concerns about due process during deportations. First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Government layoffs began today at the Food and Drug Administration and at the National Institutes of Health. NPR's Sydney Lupkin says it's all part of President Trump's effort to cut the Department of Health and Human Services by 25%.
Emails went out to FDA staffers early Tuesday morning that they no longer had jobs. According to an HHS fact sheet, 3,500 FDA jobs are being eliminated. It says the drug, device, and food reviewers and inspectors will be spared. Many FDA staffers and their work are funded by user fees paid by the industry. Congress passed the first user fee law in 1992 to fund staffing to speed drug approvals. The fees are paid by drug and device companies as well as the makers of certain tobacco products. Some of the staffers funded by these fees tell NPR they lost their jobs too, but because they weren't paid by taxpayers, those layoffs won't save taxpayer dollars. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
The U.S. has imposed sanctions on two people and half a dozen others believed to be involved with obtaining weapons for Iran. NPR's Jackie Northam tells us that move comes as the White House increases pressure on Iran to resume talks about its nuclear weapons program.
The Treasury Department says these sanctions target a network involved in procuring drone components for the Iranian regime, including businesses in the United Arab Emirates and China, as well as two individuals in Iran. In a statement, the Treasury Department says Iran's proliferation of drones and missiles to its allies in the Mideast threatens the U.S. and its partners in the region. The sanctions are part of Trump's decision to reimpose a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran to come to an agreement over its nuclear program. On Sunday, Trump threatened to bomb Iran, but said negotiations would be better. On Monday, Iran rejected direct negotiations with the U.S. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
The FDA is recalling more than 200,000 pounds of liquid eggs, but this recall has nothing to do with bird flu, as NPR's Giles Snyder reports.
The products being recalled may contain a bleach cleaning solution. However, the Federal Agriculture Department says its scientists have determined the risk is negligible. The recall affects egg beaters and Bob Evans liquid egg substitutes made by Michigan-based Cargill Kitchen Solutions. The products were shipped earlier this month to distributors in Texas and Ohio and for food service use in Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, and Iowa. The recall comes amid the recent egg shortage caused by bird flu. Wholesale prices, however, have been falling lately. Bird flu has been slowing down and imports have risen. But with Easter and Passover approaching, officials warn prices may start inching back up. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
California relies on snow in the Sierra Nevada for year-round drinking water, and this year's snowpack is near normal at 90%, but despite some recent rainstorms, it's the first below-average snowpack since 2022. Melting snow from the Sierra Nevada supplies about a third of California's water supply, on average. Lake Tahoe is forecast to get another 5 feet of new snow, and that has skiers and snowboarders stoked this late in the season. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration is acknowledging that it deported a man to a Salvadoran mega prison by mistake. That admission came in court papers filed last night in the case of a Maryland father who had protected legal status in the U.S. The White House says it has no intention of bringing him back, despite the, quote, administrative error that led to his deportation. NPR's Joel Rose is following this, and he's in the studio. Hey, Joel.
Hey, Ari.
Who is this man, and why was he deported?
His name is Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia. He's originally from El Salvador. He's been living in Maryland since 2011, when he fled his native country because of gang threats. In 2019, he was arrested in the U.S. and was accused by another man of being a member of the MS-13 gang. Abrego Garcia was not charged with a crime, although he was put into removal proceedings in immigration court. He fought that case, and he won. Ultimately, an immigration judge granted a form of legal protection called withholding of removal, because it found that Abrego Garcia was more likely than not to face harm if he was sent back to El Salvador. In spite of that, ICE officers arrested Abrego Garcia in Maryland last month outside a relative's home. And a few days later, he was deported to El Salvador, along with hundreds of other men who are accused of being members of MS-13 or the Venezuelan gang called Tren de Aragua.
Well, now that the administration has admitted it made a mistake, what happens to the man?
Abrego Garcia's lawyers want the Trump administration to bring him back, but so far the White House is refusing to do that. Lawyers for the Trump administration say there was a paperwork error that led to his deportation, but they argue that federal courts do not have the authority to order his return because he is already out of the country in a maximum security prison in El Salvador. Abrego Garcia's lawyers vehemently disagree with that. They say the Trump administration should have gone back to immigration court if it wanted to deport him. Here's his attorney, Simon Sandoval Motionberg, speaking today with NPR's Here and Now.
If they are allowed to deport people whom the law prohibits them from deporting, then those laws are meaningless, right? We might as well not even have immigration courts. We might as well not even have immigration laws if the government can just ignore those courts' orders, can just ignore those laws, and then take the position that there's nothing that anyone can do about it after the fact.
Sandoval Motionberg says the Trump administration should start by simply asking El Salvador to return his client.
Is there any chance of the White House doing that? What are you hearing from the administration?
Well, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt today acknowledged that Abrego Garcia was deported in error, but she also claimed that he is not innocent.
The administration maintains the position that this individual who was deported to El Salvador and will not be returning to our country was a member of the brutal and vicious MS-13 gang.
Leavitt accused Abrego Garcia of involvement in human trafficking and being a leader of MS-13. And she doubled down on the unsupported claim made by Vice President J.D. Vance that he is a convicted gang member. But there is no evidence to support any of that, and Leavitt did not provide any today. Abrego Garcia's lawyers say he has never been convicted of a crime in the U.S. or any other country, and they deny that he is a member of MS-13.
This is just the latest indication that the Trump administration made mistakes when it quickly deported hundreds of men to El Salvador. Where does this case fit into the bigger picture?
Yeah, this appears to be the first time the Trump administration has acknowledged an error. The White House still maintains that all of the men it deported to El Salvador were gang members, although it has released little evidence to support those claims. We have heard from families and lawyers, though, for a growing number of these men who say they're not gang members, that they were deported largely, if not entirely, based on their tattoos, and that they had no due process, no chance to contest those allegations. And it is not just progressive immigrant advocates who are expressing concern about these deportations. The popular podcast host Joe Rogan, who has supported President Trump, also weighed in over the weekend. Rogan said it is, quote, horrific to imagine innocent people sent to a Salvadoran prison, and that, quote, mistakes like that have to be corrected, unquote, if you want reasonable people to support what you're doing. But that is not the way the White House is approaching this, at least not so far.
NPR's Joel Rose, thank you.
Welcome.
Alabama has a strict abortion ban, no exceptions for rape or incest. As in other places with bans, some patients have been traveling to other states to get an abortion. Well, groups in Alabama that want to help those patients have been afraid of being prosecuted. Now, a federal judge has ruled in favor of those groups. Here to explain is Drew Hawkins, public health reporter in the Gulf States newsroom. Hi, Drew.
Hey, Mary Louise. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. Tell me about these groups who have feared prosecution. Who are they?
Yeah, so you've got these groups in Alabama that provide financial support to patients so they can leave Alabama and travel to another state. And then you've also got doctors or clinical staff, and for them it's been really unclear what they could say to patients. Could they refer them or connect them to resources in other states? And some were even afraid to suggest to patients that they could go out of state for an abortion, that was even an option. And this fear, it goes all the way back to 2022, not long after the Supreme Court ruled on Roe v. Wade. That's when Alabama's Attorney General Steve Marshall said he might bring charges against those groups or doctors, that he had a right to prosecute anyone who helped a woman get an abortion in another state.
And this new federal court ruling, what did it have to say about that?
Yeah, so those abortion rights groups, they sued the attorney general. And on Monday, the federal judge in Alabama, Myron Thompson, he sided with them. The judge basically said that they can't be prosecuted, because if they were, that would violate their First Amendment speech rights and also the right to travel. So in practical terms, it means these groups can start assisting patients again without fear of criminal prosecution. And, you know, what they do is these are groups that help pay for things like tickets, gas, or food, and sometimes the abortion procedure itself. And they can also provide advice or information about where the nearest out-of-state clinics are.
A significant win here, then, for reproductive rights supporters in Alabama. How are they responding?
Yeah, so I talked to Robin Marty. She's the executive director of West Alabama Women's Center in Tuscaloosa. Uh-huh. That's one of the groups that filed the suit. And they used to provide abortions, and now they focus on services like contraception and prenatal care. And here's what she said about the ruling.
I mean, victories are very few and far between in Alabama when it comes to reproductive rights.
And another organization that joined the lawsuit is the Yellowhammer Fund. And they provide financial support to traveling patients, but they stopped doing that in 2022. Janice Fountain is the executive director of Yellowhammer, and she told me they got right back to work last night after the ruling.
The decision came at about 5:30. I think we funded an abortion at 5:45, because that's how severe the need is. That's how urgent it is that we get back to the work that we're doing.
Okay, so a couple of voices there from abortion rights advocates. Mm-hmm. What about Steve Marshall, the Alabama Attorney General you were telling us about?
Yeah, so in a statement, he said that they're considering their options, but he could appeal the ruling. And law professor Mary Ziegler at UC Davis said she'd be surprised if he doesn't appeal. And she thinks it could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
We're just seeing kind of a multiplying of conflicts where, you know, we have unanswered questions about the meaning of the First Amendment in this context, about the right to travel in this context, about due process in this context, about these sort of clashing state laws and choosing which one applies.
So Ziegler thinks the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be more involved in abortion cases. There are other battles over things like mailing abortion pills over state lines, for example.
That is Drew Hawkins, health reporter in New Orleans with the Gulf States Newsroom. Thank you so much, Drew.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. When people flee domestic violence and check into a shelter, it's usually with the understanding that the location will be kept secret to keep survivors safe from abusers. But now some shelters say there are lots of benefits to disclosing their locations. Aspen Public Radio's Hallie Zander reports.
Last year, in a small rural town near Aspen, Colorado, Elizabeth was trying to leave an abusive relationship. She reached out to a local nonprofit called Response for help. Within 24 hours, they moved her into an apartment in a confidential location. We're not using her full name and having someone else read her comments because she's afraid her abuser could identify and try to contact her.
I can't even express how helpful it was to be able to leave a really bad situation. And without that, I don't know where I'd be right now.
While settling in, nonprofit staff explained the rules. She wasn't allowed to tell anyone, even friends or family, where she was living, for her own security. She says that made sense, but...
When I closed the door, and if anything were to happen, I was really there by myself. Would anyone know if he came and found me? If he broke in?
She didn't always feel safe, and lately, some advocates for domestic abuse victims are questioning whether concealing shelter locations actually is safer.
In some ways, it's the illusion of safety more than the reality of safety.
Clinical psychologist Lisa Goodman did a study in 2020 that found there's no longer a clear connection between a secret shelter space and increased safety. So when a new shelter in the nearby town of Basalt made its address public, Goodman wasn't surprised.
Basalt is a good example. It's so small that there's no way they can have a concealed location. And I think that is true all over the country, especially in rural areas.
And it's true in cities too, Goodman says. Any taxi driver who drops a family off or a kid who tells a friend where they're staying could compromise these secret locations.
Our first room here is a single room.
The Basalt shelter went public from the start. They hosted an open house with a champagne toast and group tours, drawing dozens of people to see the new building. Executive Director Shannon Meyer says the thought of keeping their shelter location a secret was daunting.
That was one of my sort of mental blocks to being able to do a shelter before this. Like, as soon as we pulled a building permit, people would know what we were doing. Our location would be known.
With demand for affordable shelter growing, Meyer embraced not hiding the new facility's location. Advocates hope that if shelters are prominent and visible, abusers are less likely to stalk or harass victims there.
Here we're saying there are people in our community who have experienced abuse, and we have built this beautiful place for them to come to stay. And they deserve a beautiful place.
The shelter also includes safeguards like panic buttons, keypads, and a staff apartment on site.
I have mixed feelings about it.
University of Colorado professor Joanne Belknap is still skeptical. Her research shows a disproportionate rate of domestic violence deaths in Colorado's rural areas.
The most dangerous time is when women leave their abusers, so people knowing where the shelter is, that's kind of scary to me.
There's no consensus among people running domestic violence shelters on whether publicly acknowledging their locations is actually safer. The authors of the 2020 study, advocating more transparency, say they're only aware of a handful that have switched away from confidentiality. For NPR News, I'm Hallie Zander in Aspen, Colorado.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
We'll be right back.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A trip to the Louvre is the museum version of a blood sport. You need to be ready for the fight. So writes Elaine Chelino in her new book about the Louvre. Chelino is a former Paris bureau chief for the New York Times, and the book is part journalism, part memoir, part art history. It is titled Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. Elaine Chelino is on the line from Paris. Bonjour, bienvenue.
Oh, what a great accent you've got. Gosh, it's better than I still sound like an American here.
Well, you're very, very welcome on All Things Considered. I have to start. You have all kinds of tips for visiting the Louvre, and I want to dive in there because you instruct us we should arrive straight from a cafe, ideally having fortified yourself with a traditional correctly toasted croque-monsieur, which sounds like great advice for pretty much everything in life. Forget just visiting the Louvre.
Well, absolutely. You know, I have one mantra, which I tell everybody, never go to the Louvre on an empty stomach or with a full bladder, because everybody sort of thinks, oh, I think I'll just walk from Omer to the Louvre today, and then I'll just go to the toilet when I get in and grab something to eat. No, this doesn't happen.
Bad idea.
Be prepared before.
Okay, but really a blood sport and be ready for the fight? That sounds dramatic.
The Louvre is a tough place. It's not supposed to be fun. It's kind of like running a half marathon for the first time. You don't know what you're going to face, and you just have to be ready for anything. Look, this is the biggest and most visited museum in the world, and you've got to accept that it's too crowded and too confusing. 400 rooms.
400 rooms. It's overwhelming. Except one of the things that jumped out at me early in your book is you write, a lot of visitors can feel underwhelmed. That feels counterintuitive.
You can feel underwhelmed because of your expectations. You come to the Louvre, you wait forever to get in, you finally get in, and there are just too many people in the Camembert, which is where you have to maneuver to get up to one of the wings. And you're excited, you're there perhaps for the first time, and you have to go see the Mona Lisa. You finally get to her, and she's small, and you can't get close to her. And you say, I spent all that time and money for this? And that's what I mean by underwhelmed, is that she doesn't naturally carry you away, and you don't have some epiphany and great feeling about life. You think, oh my gosh, is that all there is?
And where is the bathroom, by the way?
And where's the bathroom? And yeah, it's kind of like a disappointing lover for the first time. You know, you sort of think, oh God, okay, is this what it's going to be like?
Well, back up and give us a little bit of the history, because the Louvre, as you detail, it wasn't built as a place to show great art to the people. It was built, it was a fortress, it was an arsenal, it was a prison. I mean, briefly, how did it come to be a museum?
Well, first of all, no one can even give you a good answer about why it's called the Louvre and how did it get that name. I mean, for centuries before anything was built on that plot of land, that land was called the Louvre. But there are all sorts of theories about the word. You know, it comes from the French word perhaps for she-wolf. So maybe the site was inhabited by wolves, mm-hmm. or there's other theories. Maybe it was named after a fortified castle or a leper colony or an ancient signal tower or a plantation of oak trees. No one can tell you the answer. So right from the beginning, you don't know what you're getting into. And as you said, it wasn't built as a museum. I mean, some people complain about the Met in New York City, the Metropolitan Museum. They say it's big and confusing and cold, but at least it was built as a place to show great art. I mean, the Louvre began in the Middle Ages, at the end of the 12th century, and it was built as a fortress to protect Paris. And then it was turned into a palace for the kings. Mm. And basically, they didn't really like it as a palace. So that eventually it was turned into a museum at the French Revolution.
Oh. Circle back to the Mona Lisa, because you write about how the museum staff has a love-hate relationship with Mona Lisa. And I want to know why.
The Mona Lisa is both a blessing and a curse. About 80% of first-time visitors come primarily to see the Mona Lisa. There's no other museum in the world that is so identified with one work of art. But who the heck can explain the cult of the Mona Lisa? I mean, she's not the Virgin Mary. She's not even a saint. But she is the best-known artwork in the entire world. The director of paintings doesn't really like the Mona Lisa. And I asked him one day, I said, so are there other paintings, portraits that are more beautiful than the Mona Lisa? And he said, yeah, there really are. And I said, oh, will you take me to find a few of them? And so one day we went looking for paintings that he considers even more extraordinary than the Mona Lisa.
One of my favorite stories that you tell in this book is about how you met the curator, I guess it's the curator in charge of 16th century Italian painting. And his job, among his jobs, is to open the Mona Lisa's fan mail.
Oh, yeah. Did you know that there are hundreds of letters that have been written to the Mona Lisa over the years, and letters written about and to the Mona Lisa? I mean, some people actually think she's alive and they write to her, you know, dear Mona, could you please help me with my love life? I need your help, blah, blah, blah. I mean, other letters are written to the head of the museum saying she looks yellow, not because she has varnish, but because she has jaundice. But they treat her in many of these letters as a live person who actually exists.
To circle us back to where we began and the vastness of the Louvre and how easy it is to get lost and how hard it is to find a snack. The value of getting lost, of going in with no agenda whatsoever and just seeing what strikes your eye on any given day?
This is really important to tell your listeners. And it's important for any museum. You have to find out what kind of a museum goer you are. And sometimes you're a first timer, and that's the hardest because you're like a warrior and you have to wear good shoes and be ready to do battle. But you can also be what I call a flaneur or a wanderer. And this is the most liberating way to see the Louvre or just about any museum, where you give yourself the freedom to get lost. And you just say to yourself, I'm just going to wander around and find something new to discover. And you will find something beautiful. And that is, in this era that we're in, of so much turmoil, of so much uncertainty, of so much up and down, of so much being assaulted by the news, to be able to go into a museum and to make contact even with one work of art and feel the beauty of that work of art and the genius of the artist, it carries you away.
Elaine Cialino, speaking with us from Paris about her new book, Adventures in the Louvre. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone. At betterhelp.com/public.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Bamba, nooka 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 bamba. Bamba, nooka 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 bamba. If you've seen psychiatrists and you are still a mixed up cat, you should go to Africa to the rich witch doctor in the tall silk hat. Bamba, nooka 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 bamba. Bamba, nooka 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 bamba.
I'm speaking of Dr. Geek from Tanganyika.
The rich witch doctor geek from Tanganyika. If psychiatry is what you seek, be